for most of us, we work, make enough money to pay the bills, maybe even put some money aside. But for millions of people all over the world, even some countries, it's family members living abroad, expats, that they rely on to keep their lives, their economies afloat.
There was one anecdote, still I remember. I was expecting money, and there was a registered letter that came in. When I went to the post office, instead of money, there was a picture of somebody's foot drawn with his pencil.
A foot.
A picture of a foot. And the guy actually was saying, could you please buy a pair of shoes and bring it? Because the shoes were not available in the village. And what I needed on the other side was really money. And I got instead, it felt like, you know, getting hit by a pair of shoes.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. Yeah.
So my name is Dilip Ratha. I work in the World Bank as a lead economist for migration and remittances.
Dilip Ratha has drawn from his own personal journey, from a childhood in a poor village to a hungry college student, to eventually become a leading voice on the power of remittances to reduce global poverty.
They are timely, they are large, they are stable, and that even better, they're counter-cyclical.
Dilip Ratha's article, titled Resilient Remittances, is published in the September issue of Finance and Development magazine. He spoke to journalist Rhoda Metcalf about his work.
I came into remittances first from a finance angle. Prior to working on remittances, I was working on capital flows to developing countries. And prior to that, I was working in an investment bank. This is just to say that I was into hardcore, cutting-edge finance. And then Asian financial crisis happened. And then there was this search for financing for poor countries. I looked at remittances, the flow of money sent by migrants back home. The striking fact at that time in 2001, remittance flows were about 1.5 times the size of official development assistance, official aid. That was a moment of revelation in a way that you have all these small amounts of money sent by probably millions of migrants back home, and that amount was larger than official aid. And myself being also a person who sends money and realizing how important sending money or receiving money on the other side is for the recipient, it immediately struck a chord that these are not only large flows, these are flows that are directly targeted to the needs of the people. That's why the impact is so much more significant in terms of reducing poverty, in terms of providing funding for the right reasons. And in fact, when you look at countries that are impacted by also war and conflict, those are the countries where pretty much the only kinds of flows coming from outside are remittances. Take Somalia or Afghanistan. The money that is coming in, that is literally the lifeline for those economies, are remittances.
Right, or your the families that are somewhere else in the world that are sending money home.
Exactly.
Right, and you have sort of a personal connection to that. You're saying you yourself have sent money. What is your personal connection to the remittance experience?
Well, you know, for somebody who grew up in a village, you know, early on, I was 16 when I had to leave to go to college.
Leave where?
In Orissa, in a small village it's called Odisha now.
In India.
In India. And from that village, which got electricity the first time when I was 9th grade. Oh. Before that, we didn't have electricity and there wasn't running water at that time. So there was only high school education there, which is where I studied. And after high school, I had to go to college. That was about 200 kilometers away. My father had to send me money. So I had the early experience of receiving money from my father. And after that, when I started working in Delhi, I had to send money home to my father and to my brother. So I started having experience from the other side as a sender of remittances. And then I came to the U.S. and I was sending money throughout. So yes, I have had practical experience. In the early days, my father would go to the post office and give the rupees, Indian rupees, to the postmaster and sign a form and hand it over to him. And then 7 days, 10 days later, the mailman would bring it to my dorm in the college. One never really knew when the money would arrive, if at all.
Right.
There was one anecdote that still I remember. I was expecting money, and I was borrowing from friends to pay for my meals at that time.
To tide you over.
There was a registered letter that came in when I went to the post office. Instead of money, there was a picture of somebody's foot who had drawn with his pencil.
A foot.
A picture of a foot. And the guy actually was saying, could you please buy a pair of shoes and bring it of this size? This was a person from the village. And
somebody from your village sent a picture of his foot so that you could get him some shoes.
Yeah, because the shoes were not available in the village. And what I needed on the other side was really money. And I got instead, it felt like, you know, getting hit by a pair of shoes.
Yeah, exactly. Wow.
So that phenomenon of sending money being so difficult, you know, when it was international money transfer, it was even more difficult, because when I was in the U.S., first as a student and then as a World Bank employee sending money, I would literally send a check.
Through the mail system.
Through the mail system. And it would arrive on the other side in 10 days' time. Then my father would have to physically travel to the nearest town where there is a bank and deposit it there, and then go there every month and check with the bank. And some point, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, as much as 12 weeks later, he would receive some money. And at that time, it didn't seem odd, but the cost of sending money through the postal system is 5%. It still is 5% in India and in most countries in the world. And 5% to send money for poor people is a 5% tax that goes to the government. Of course, they are providing a service, but it is too much even now.
But surely that has changed over time, no? Hasn't it? I mean, we have all of these digital means of sending money now with our cell phones. Surely that has improved.
Globally, we monitor remittance prices worldwide, and the average cost of sending money to the developing countries is about 6%, slightly over 6%.
Okay.
To send money to Africa, it is still more than 8%.
Hmm.
And within Africa, it's a little-known fact that two-thirds of migrants, 70% of the international migrants within sub-Saharan Africa are migrating within sub-Saharan Africa to other countries.
Neighboring countries.
To the neighboring countries. And when they send money, they have to pay the foreign exchange conversion costs twice. First from, let's say, Kenyan shilling to the dollar.
Right.
From the dollar, maybe in Senegal, it would be to euro, and from euro to CFA franc. So at least twice they have to pay. Internally, within Africa, interregional remittances probably cost anywhere from 12 to 30%.
Wow.
And we don't know how long it takes. I was in Nairobi in June for the International Day of Family Remittances. There is now an International Day of Family Remittances announced by the UN, June 16.
Wow.
And I met a number of money transfer company executives. And they all say that the process has improved dramatically for intra-regional remittances as well. But they could not answer a simple question: how much does it cost?
Right.
They said it doesn't cost much, meaning that they don't charge too much. That's not enough, because the real charge is in the Foreign Exchange Commission. The reason the premium, the markup for currency conversion will remain high is because the banks that are involved in this process of changing money, they do make a substantial income from currency conversion.
Yes.
And they would not allow anybody else to make that money either, meaning that it would be almost impossible to generate real competition in the foreign exchange market.
Right.
And that is a market failure.
Is there some solution then? Is there some way to get around it?
I think that's where public policy has to step in. Public policy, so IMF, World Bank can play a role. We don't go into interfering in individual markets. But we could think about creating intra-regional cross-country trading platforms, supporting them. And we can actually work with governments to fix their exchange rate regimes. But to be able to do that, they have to have the right kind of macroeconomic policy environment as well. So there is a huge role for public policy.
Right, right. I have the impression when I read your articles and listen to your talks about remittances that you feel that to a certain extent remittances are underappreciated.
You know, 20 years ago, or even I would say 10 years ago, remittances were considered errors and omissions or small change. And they were not properly measured.
Because they were such small amounts.
They were small amounts. They were difficult to track. And there was this unfortunate situation of, you know, the September 11, 2001, those terrorist attacks.
Oh, 9-11.
9-11. That put a stigma wrongly on remittances.
How so?
Those guys, the terrorists, were receiving money. You know, you have billions of transactions, and then probably, you know, a handful, 100 transactions, maybe 1,000 transactions in a year have some kind of illegality associated with them. And then the entire legal structure in the world, led by the richer countries, goes after the millions of small transactions. So there is this anti-money laundering and the countering of the financing of terrorism regulations, AML, CFT regulations.
That came in after 9-11.
That came in after 9-11. And they, in fact, became more and more stringent, even as the size and developmental impact of remittances was recognized more and more. But I'm doing a paper as we speak on long-term shifts in capital flows to developing countries.
Right.
And the striking message coming out, it's even a surprise to me, someone who monitors these flows all the time, is that compared to 10 years ago, capital flows to developing countries are down by 56%, significantly down.
Right.
In that period, remittances have more than doubled. And I cannot imagine a scenario for the next 20 years that remittances would ever come down. In 2022, remittances were $647 billion as flowing to low and middle income countries. Right. Foreign direct investment flowing from all the multinational companies in the world was less than that.
Right. But I also wondered whether or not host countries, countries where migrants live, are they necessarily motivated to make it easier for migrants to send money back home? Because in a sense, the easier it is to send money back home, the more you are encouraging people to come, to migrate, and to start working there. And not every country necessarily wants to encourage more migration.
That is absolutely correct. And in fact, some countries have also started thinking about taxing remittances. So this is very much on the cards. Now, this is where one has to separate the migration phenomenon from the remittance phenomenon. Most of the migrants are economic migrants who have migrated to take up a job. They wouldn't be there for too long in the destination if there wasn't any demand for it.
Right.
Households, as well as small businesses, as well as large businesses, they all hire the doctors and nurses and housekeepers and the gardeners. Migrants are doing all kinds of things, especially the dirty and dangerous jobs and highly skilled jobs. That's where migrants are there. So without migration, the family or the business employer, they would have to pay a higher price or forego that service. They would not have that service. So maybe the working parents, they're not able to go to work because there is no child care.
Sure.
Once we recognize that, the value of migration, that it is a win-win, then the next question is, should we allow remittances or not? And the answer is very simple. These guys worked for you. You paid them. You can't then say that, you know, they have already paid their taxes, whatever is necessary for them to pay. You can't then say that they can't send money home.
Sure.
You cannot tax them twice or three times or four times. So in that sense, this is a flawed logic that facilitating remittances somehow also encourages more migration. I think in that picture, what is really not understood by people is migration is painful. You don't do that just like, it's not a fun thing to do.
People don't want to leave home.
You don't want to leave home. You don't want to leave your family and friends back home, your language, your culture, your weather, whatever it is. That's why 97% of the world's population, 285 million out of 8.4 billion or something people, only 3% migrated, 97% don't migrate.
I mean, do you espouse the idea that countries should allow more immigration as a means, or at least allow more migrant workers to you know, be part of their economy as a substitute for foreign aid, in a way, as a substitute for trying to put money into countries from the outside?
I wouldn't put it as a substitute. Foreign aid is meant for addressing market failures, for
systemic,
addressing climate change and other global public goods or public challenges. You know, you can't expect migrants to build roads back home. You can't expect migrants to put utilities back home, improve hospitals or schools. So public aid has a purpose, and more public aid is needed. On the other question on migration, more migration is also needed. The average income pre-COVID of the high-income countries was 35,000 plus per capita income. The average per capita income in low-income countries pre-COVID was $700. It's a difference of 1 to 54. So what we see now, all those people trying to cross the seas, the Mediterranean and the Darien Gap here, that pressure is going to multiply. So we have a problem. I think migration is a more pressing challenge that we have not been focusing on. So in all this dark scenario, remittances are a bright spot. You know, they're a great way of sharing prosperity between places. People move and then they send money home, and, you know, it really helps everyone.
Do you feel that the remittances that you have paid back to your own homeland, has it borne fruit?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, I have a brother with two PhDs. I have a sister with another PhD. I provided the help, and they had the willingness to use that help to translate that into something meaningful. So they are gainfully employed. So I had some impact. Clearly, I can see that. And, you know, increasingly, now that we are not sending money to support families back home, all of us send money for charitable purposes, to support a school, support some kind of a community hall. People come to us all the time for request for help, like somebody has a health condition, a surgery has to be done. So because we are able, we can support.
Right.
No, there is a flip side of creating dependence. That also is a risk. But overall, I think, it has benefited a lot of people and my community back home. Yeah.
Right. Well, Dilip Ratha, I thank you so much for giving, you know, a lot of your time to us to understand better this very important issue of remittances. And thank you for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Again, that was Dilip Ratha, lead economist for migration and remittances at the World Bank, speaking with Rhoda Metcalf. His latest article, Resilient Remittances, is published in the September issue of Finance and Development magazine. Check it out at imf.org/FND. And look for other IMF podcasts at imf.org/podcasts or wherever you listen. You can also follow us on X, the platform formerly known as Twitter, at IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards.
And I'm Rhoda Metcalf. Thanks for listening.